loving kindness, compassion, and joy. Hello, I'm Ken MacLeod, Principal Teacher of Unfettered Mind. Studying and meditating on the Four Immeasurables have played an important part in my own practice. In this six-part series, recorded in Los Angeles, you'll hear not just a series of Dharma talks, but also discussions with students and specific meditation instructions on each of the Four Immeasurables. And now, part one. So, we're going to begin what's a six-session class on the Four Immeasurables. And I think, as all of you know, we're going to be meeting every other week, not every week as we have in the past. On the alternate weeks, the regular Tuesday group will be meeting here. Is that right? And so anybody in the class is welcome to join. And this is a group of students that have been studying and practicing, most for quite a long period of time, but also some newer people who get together and practice and also interact around their practice, and they've learned how to do this in a way that is mutually beneficial. And that's a very good skill to learn. So all of you are welcome to attend that. Yes?
7:30.
7:30, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Now, this evening, I want to cover a few points. One is to set the context for the Four Immeasurables. Where does it sit in the whole realm of Buddhist practice? Second, there are two approaches there are several approaches to these meditations. There's the one that I've described in Wake Up to Your Life, and there's a second one which I'll be introducing this week, which is actually tonight. Which is actually much simpler. It works on somewhat different principles, and I want to explain how that's done in the context of equanimity practice, which is where we're going to start. So in terms of cultivating the Four Immeasurables, 12 weeks, which is what we have, is a very, very short period of time. But I think it'll be long enough for you to at least get a taste of these and understand how the various meditation practices work and go from there. So let's start with the context. Four Immeasurables is the Mahayana equivalent of what is known in the Theravadan tradition as the four abodes of Brahmins. The actual Pali or Sanskrit term is Brahmavihara. And they are loving-kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And they're called the four abodes because this is where a noble person hangs out. It's in loving-kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. As Buddhism evolved and the Mahayana evolved, the name was changed to the Four Immeasurables. And I think this has something to do with the Mahayana emphasis on limitless space. And we find this reflected in the the Zen version of the Bodhisattva vow, sentient beings are infinite, I vow to save them all, and so forth. These four qualities, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, in ordinarily Western thinking, we regard those as emotions. And this immediately creates a little confusion because in many contexts in Buddhism, emotions are regarded as bad things. You know, we're trying to be free of emotional confusion and emotional projection. So how do we reconcile this with these emotions of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity? Well, one way of looking at this is that there is a qualitative difference between such emotions as anger, pride, and greed, etc., and loving kindness and compassion and equanimity. And the difference to my mind is that the first group of emotions are organized around a sense of self and function to maintain and reinforce that sense of self. So if you take a look at the emotion anger, we get angry at anything which threatens our sense of identity, whether it's our physical identity, i.e. our survival, emotional identity, our emotional needs, or our picture of who we think we are. When something threatens that, we get angry and we seek to destroy it. And with the emotion desire, anything that supports that sense of self, we seek to own and possess and get more of. Makes us feel good. Equanimity doesn't work that way. It doesn't reinforce a sense of self. Nor does it reinforce a sense of other. So there's something qualitatively different about the way equanimity functions. Loving kindness is a little trickier because we confuse that with love and affection, which either of which can be very much in the thrall of a sense of self. But true loving kindness is wanting the other person to be happy. No strings. It's open. Or to put it a different way, it's radiant warmth. And this special quality of these emotions was captured by William Shakespeare in a line which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. I remember this very well because it was the first Shakespearean play that I studied, and our teacher drilled this into us. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as a gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. And so this verse illustrates another key point with respect to the immeasurables. And that is that they have a transformative power. And whether it's compassion or loving kindness or equanimity or joy, when you just have that open, let's take loving kindness, that open wish that others be happy, or that the person you're with be happy, and they feel it, both of you are united in a moment of presence. There's radiant warmth, and the other person's receiving radiant warmth. When you're on the receiving end of loving kindness, you experience no separation from the world. That's very profound. When you are expressing loving kindness, you experience no separation, nor any sense of ownership or control or anything like that. So you can see that these emotions function in a very different way from other emotions, such as anger and desire and greed and so forth. So for that reason, I sometimes refer to them as the higher emotions, or if I'm feeling mischievous, the impersonal emotions, because they don't reinforce a sense of being a person or your personality. They actually open things up. I like to play with words that way sometimes. They aren't the reactive emotions. These aren't emotional reactions. And that's the distinction. Now, these practices and the practices to cultivate these emotions play different roles in different traditions of Buddhism. In the Theravadan tradition, loving-kindness primarily, and the others following, are used very deliberately to generate high states of energy, of emotional energy, which is then used to power attention. In the Mahayana, the four immeasurables are used primarily as a basis for the generation of compassion, using such techniques as taking and sending and many others. And then compassion is used to transform one's experience of the world. Zen tradition, and we'll be taking a look at the way Zen approaches this with this book. These are seen as ways that natural awareness expresses itself in the world. So they're coming, as is typically Zen, from a very high level. So in some traditions, these are regarded as energy transformation techniques. In others, they're regarded as ways to work through emotional material, purification practices. And in others, they're regarded as qualities that manifest naturally as the result of understanding and insight. We're going to approach them in this practice, in the way that we're going to work here over the next few weeks, as partially as energy transformation practices and partially as ways of coming in touch and learning how to be present in deep-seated emotional material. Properly speaking, I would not say these are beginner's practices. These are about middle-level practices, for the most part. But like many, many practices of Buddhism, they can be and have been taken by many great teachers in the past as the basis for practice. They're like a wish fulfilling of one of the old mythical symbols in Indian Buddhism is the wish-fulfilling cow. The cow just granted. The cow was the source of everything. You know, it's a source of food and fuel and all kinds of things. So this was a symbol. But you can work with these as deeply as you wish, and they will just continue to nourish your practice. In the Mahayana particularly, compassion is regarded as the central path. And so in practicing these, one was laying a foundation for that particular path. And in my own training in the Tibetan tradition and advanced yogas and things like that, these practices are really, really important to keep you from going astray, to keep bringing you in touch with how things actually are, because it's very easy to get to ride on energy and lose some kind of connection with the world. Now, in this work, and in any work in spiritual practice, it's very important to understand what you're doing with a particular practice. So I want to spend some time on this evening. And this is just, I'm working from from page 253 in this little book. Four efforts. Know the purpose, trust the method, understand what happens in practice, and accept the results. Now, it's quite astonishing how many people practice a particular form of meditation and really don't understand what the meditation is meant to do or why they are doing it. And then they wonder why they run into problems, you know, 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, or a year or 2 years down the line. So the purpose of this practice, well, let's leave that for a moment. We have the mics ready? Mm-hmm. We don't have to go around everybody, but I'd like to hear from some of you anyway. Very simple question. Why are you here?
Someone's got to record the class.
Agnes?
To minimize suffering.
Whose?
I guess if there's a no self, but I'm suffering.
So it's your suffering. Okay. You're here to minimize suffering. No, you got the mic. We have a little chat now. Are you here to minimize suffering or to end suffering?
I'm not presumptive enough to think that I could end suffering, so I work at the intermediate step, minimizing.
That's very interesting. I want all of you to take a situation in your life. In which you tried to minimize the suffering in that situation. So maybe it was a conversation with your partner or spouse. Maybe it was how you handled a certain situation at work. Julia's grinning ecstatically over there. Because this is what we generally do. We try to minimize the suffering. Okay, so have all of you got a situation in mind? Okay. How successful were you? You know, you tried to avoid all of that hurt and it didn't quite work. We'll just leave it as it didn't quite work, okay? Now I want you to think of something else. I want you to take that same situation. How would you have acted if your intention was to end the suffering? Would that have made a difference? Several of you are nodding your heads. So let's hear from a couple of you. What's the difference? Chuck.
I think if you're trying to minimize suffering, you're still closed up. But if you're trying to end suffering, you open up and let the cards fall where they may.
Very interesting. Okay. I think that's basically right. But let's hear from some other people. Anybody else? Julia.
I think when I'm trying to minimize it, I'm still trying to get something from the situation, but with a minimum amount of pain.
Which usually turns out to be the maximum amount.
Exactly. Whereas when you're trying to actually end the suffering, there's something you have to do, and that usually involves sacrificing something that's to do with your what you want.
And you stop trying to protect and...
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Darren.
The word that comes to mind when I think about this is euthanasia.
I guess I'm going to have to ask you to expand on that. Which is euthanasia? Is that minimizing the suffering? Or?
Well, stopping the suffering might result in the putting something out of its misery.
Yeah. Okay. That something may be part of us, right?
It may be part of us or maybe part of a dynamic.
Okay.
But it's in the destroying part of the...
Well, it may be destroying. But the point that I was trying to bring up here is when you think of minimizing suffering, you can feel how there's all of that entanglement and enmeshment, etc., and there's all of that maneuvering. But when you think of ending suffering, things get a lot clearer, don't they? Okay. You don't agree, Agnes? There's a microphone right there.
The intention could be ending the suffering, but the reality, you know, obviously everybody wants to end all suffering. Realistically, how do you do it?
Ah, now we get to the next point. How do you do it? Okay. So, we started this because I asked, why are you here? And Agnes said, to minimize suffering. So we had this little chat. Let's hear from somebody else. Why are you here? Sean.
What you said about suffering, the idea of pain being mandatory in life, but suffering being optional.
And in theory.
In theory, that comes down to a certain amount of acceptance. And in that acceptance, I'm left with holding unmet need. And I don't do that very well. So I guess I'm here to learn how to better hold the unmet need.
Okay. Very good. One other person. Why are you here? Leslie.
Well, I took the class with you years ago and found that it was, it helped transform things in my life in a way that almost nothing else has. So I'm back for a refresher.
What do you want transformed? Or what do you want to transform?
I want to work with relationships in a way that doesn't create additional trouble.
It's really pitiful.
I think that's the tip of the iceberg. Let's go for the iceberg.
I have one relationship in particular in my life that is so complicated that just keeping minimizing the hurt seems like a worthy goal. I can't help it if it's pitiful.
you're calling it pitiful, but
I mean, so
I don't think anybody else is using that word.
So when I use these practices, I can feel the relationship in a completely different way, and I see the usefulness.
Okay.
But good. I don't, you know, I don't always keep it present, so I need to work with it more.
Okay. So one of the things that I'm going to put this in slightly different language, and Leslie, you can either nod or shake your head as whether it sounds right. But one of the ways of thinking about what Leslie was just saying is that she finds that the four immeasurables practices allow her to experiencing things without the projection of thought and emotion, see things more clearly and able to relate to them just as they are. Which, and I think we need to talk about some of these terms. I'm going to throw four out: pain, hurt, suffering, and harm. Because our lives are full of relationships, not only with other people, but also the great array or range of relationships we have to different parts of ourselves. It's probably just as complicated as the relationships with everybody that we know. And just so we can be a little bit straight about vocabulary, these are the ways that I'm going to use some of these terms. Pain is a sensation. It's a sensation which can be physical or emotional. I suppose it could be cognitive as well, but which arises in certain conditions. One is holding your hand in the flame of a candle. You're going to experience pain there. And this is keying off what Sean said. Pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. You know, which always makes me think of Yogi Berra. In theory, there's no difference between practice and theory. In practice, there is. Suffering is reacting to experience or reacting to sensations. So you can have pain, but if you just experience the pain, then there's no suffering. If you react to the sensations, that's when you suffer. You know, we react in all kinds of ways. Our body tenses up and we try to stay away from it emotionally and we get all kinds of stories about it. That's where we get, that's suffering. So that's a distinction I'm going to make. Pain is sensation. Suffering is reaction to experience. And some people, they suffer when they have pleasurable experiences because they react to those in odd ways. And this is probably a little more arbitrary distinction, but I also like to distinguish between hurt and harm. Hurt occurs in relationships. You know, whenever two people interact in a way which doesn't fulfill the expectations or wishes or hopes or aspirations of the other person, they're hurt. Harm is when they're damaged in some way. So, in this world of interaction, it's probably, I won't say absolutely, but it's probably difficult to avoid hurting people from time to time. But I think we take as something very fundamental in our practice to live our lives in such a way that we don't actually harm people. Because when we harm people, what we're actually doing, or one way of thinking about what we're doing, is that we are affecting them in such a way that we're increasing their reactive tendencies and so increasing their suffering. Do you follow? Okay. So, out of this very brief discussion, come to this point. We're here to end suffering, or we're here to learn how to interact without harming people. Is that fair, Leslie? Yeah. Do you have a question? Okay. So, what is the purpose of these practices of the Four Immeasurables? The purpose is to cultivate the capacity to experience and express these emotions in our lives. Now, I'll tell you right off the bat, it's going to hurt. But it's very unlikely this is going to harm you. In fact, unless there's something fairly seriously wrong with you, it's not going to harm you. If there's something very fairly seriously wrong with you, chances are you wouldn't be here anyway, so... But one of the things I want you to do as we go through this is to gauge this. You know, do these practices actually do that? And are these practices in line with my own intention? Because many, many people, as I've said, engage in practices which don't do what they actually want. They do something quite different, and then they get confused when they're experiencing things that they... This isn't what I wanted. And an absurd example of this was a person who came to see me many, many years ago. I can't remember how many years ago. Probably in about mid-90s. He's a psychotherapist and having difficulty with his practice. And he thought meditation might help. And we agreed that we would meet for 4 sessions, which is not very long, you know. And by the second or third session, it was clear that he wasn't connecting with the practice. So I just said, why are you here? And this took a little while to sort out, but finally got the answer. What he wanted was solace. Solace. He wanted to be made to feel good. Well, how many of you find meditation makes you feel good? I mean, it does in a certain sense, but not immediately. So I looked at him and said, you know, this is the wrong place for that. And so we just ended right there. Second is trusting the method. Now, we cannot know how we're going to feel about something that we haven't experienced. That's not possible. So in the beginning, the trust that we have in a certain practice is almost always based on hearsay. It's because a friend says, oh, this is a good practice, or we read about it in a book and says, this is a really good practice, or we hear somebody say, this is a really good practice and it'll do X, Y, and Z. And because we either trust that friend, or we trust the book, or we trust the teacher, we say, okay, I'll give this a whirl. That's what I mean about it being externally based. As such, that kind of trust is relatively weak. It's unstable. But it's all we can go on. As you engage the practice and see what your own experience is with it, then a very different kind of trust develops. It's a trust that comes through your own experience. You can feel what it does in you. You can see how it changes things. So now you begin to trust the way the practice works. And because it comes from your own experience, it's a much more stable form of trust. You practice enough and you come across a third kind of trust. And that is, as with such something like the Four Immeasurables, when you come to know loving kindness yourself, for instance, you go, wow, it actually is everything it's cracked out to be. This is no longer a trust in the practice, this is a trust in the quality itself. Because now you're not separate from it all. So it's another way of putting it, it's a trust in the knowing that comes through the practice. Now, I could probably expand that into 5 levels of trust or 7, but those 3 are sufficient. One is the external, the second is internal through our own experience, and the third, we could say, is the secret or hidden. It is from knowing itself. Then the next thing. Understand what happens in practice. For many years I worked with a couple of guys in Orange County. One was an attorney, one was a management consultant. I happened to meet them both on the same day. And I asked them if they really wanted to do this. And they both immediately, I saw they were separate, but they both said, yes. You know, just seemingly enthusiastic. I suppose it was about 5 years later, because I had an office in Orange County, I would go down there for one day a week, every day, and it was about 5 years later. And the thing that amazes me is that they both did this on the same day. They came in and sat down, said, "I remember when I first met you, you asked me if I really wanted to do this. And I said yes cavalierly. I will never say yes cavalierly again." And what was remarkable is they both used the word cavalierly. T.S. Eliot and Four Quartets. I'm not sure I can quote this verbatim, but it's to the effect of, "To know what you don't know, you have to go by the way of ignorance. And to become what you are not, you have to go by the way in which you are not." There's a couple of other lines, but those are the two that I can remember. How many of you would say you're enslaved by the reactive emotions? Enslaved by reactive emotions. Okay. I have a story about that in a moment. This is about stepping out of that slavery. What's involved in becoming free of slavery? Pardon?
Fighting.
Who do you have to fight?
The captor.
Pardon?
The person who is enslaving you.
Yes.
Yourself.
Well, these patterns or whatever. And how willingly do slave masters let slaves go? Not very. So that's what's installed here. There's no escape from this. We've all learned to live a life a certain way, and the suffering that we create in our life comes from this way. And now we're going to end suffering and end our tendency to harm other people, which means stepping out of deeply, deeply habituated ways of experiencing things. And so there's a separation involved. And separation, even if it's a separation from a bad relationship, is painful. There are many good things that happen in the practice, many good things. One discovers the possibility of being free of judgment and prejudice. One discovers the possibility within oneself of radiant warmth, of being able to be completely present with another suffering and pain, and of being able to celebrate success and joy of others, which is wonderful. But all of those come by becoming free of the reactive emotions that currently operate within us. And so the way we become free of conditioning is by experiencing all, back up a step, all conditioning is an attempt to avoid pain. The way we become free of conditioning is to experience the pain that the conditioning is trying to avoid and know that that pain is not what we are. And this can only, intellectually it's useless. We have to know this experientially. And the way that that comes about is that we experience the pain comes and goes. If something comes and goes, it can't be what we are. But my saying that is useless to you. You have to actually experience it. That's how we become free. Now, that's a very brief description of what happens in this kind of practice. If you want to read more about it, read section 10 in the Karma chapter of chapter 5, and here I go into it in some detail. And now we come to the fourth effort. Accepting the results. How much control do you have over what happens in your life? Anybody think they have any control over this? A few diehards hanging on to that myth desperately. So you're going to embark on this practice. You have no idea at all what you're going to experience. I just want to be really upfront about that. I have no idea what you're going to experience. And it's probably fair to say that whatever you experience will be different from what anybody else experiences. You're walking straight into a mystery. You cannot know, you do not know what it's going to be like. So the fourth effort here is to simply accept the results. That doesn't mean to lie down and be passive. But it means that you don't try to control what you experience to conform to what you want to experience. That's how belief operates. It contorts experience and twists and molds it, etc., so that it conforms to what's inside. Accepting means just opening and experiencing that, not trying to change it. And for many of us, that's a very different way of relating to things. I have a very good friend. She's been a friend of mine, I guess, must be 20 years from now. I met her relatively soon after I came to Los Angeles, and she started her business, and I started Unfettered Mind in the same year, and we'd call each other up and said, "How are you doing?" She said, "I'm undercapitalized. How are you doing? I don't have any clients." And it went back and forth like that. Well, she just got into a relationship, and she's calling me up and saying, "Ken, I'm not used to this. I don't have any control. I'm so used to controlling everything in my life." That's how it is. The purpose of our practice here, and what we're really doing, is how to meet what we experience, not control it. And we can say that the aim of Buddhist practice is to develop the capacity to experience whatever arises, internally or externally. That's really, one may think, "Oh, that doesn't sound like much." But actually, it's huge. Because if you can actually experience whatever arises, you never have to react to a situation. That's huge. Okay, so that's as much of a frame that I want to set for these. What I want to do in the time remaining is to go over the first meditation. But before then, I'm happy to take any questions that you have on, or comments that you have on anything I've said up to this point. And if you're in raging disagreement, that's fine. Rage away. Anything you want clarified, elaborated, deleted? Got a mic for Joe?
I was really interested in rereading that chapter in your suggestion that different approaches use one of the three poisons as an energizer. Mm-hmm. For, for this work. And first of all, I'd like to know how that applies to what we're going to do. And secondly, I have an idea what using attraction might be and what using aversion might be, but I can't quite get a handle on what using indifference might look like.
Okay. Okay. The way I understood your question, you were asking about how each of the three poisons can motivate or be used as the transformation point for the practice. Is that right?
Yeah, how that might look like.
And you're particularly interested in indifference.
In what? In indifference, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, there are several ways to respond to this. The one that comes to mind is the primary method by which you, or for people who are have a strong connection with aversion, is to cultivate a relationship with death and impermanence. And for people who have a strong relationship with desire, they cultivate a relationship with suffering, because that decreases desire. And for people who have a strong relationship with indifference, they cultivate a relationship with non-self. That's usually done, at least in the Tibetan tradition, by cultivating a relationship with devotion. So if you relate to these two, four measurables, in the Theravadin, loving-kindness is used as the engine to transform. In the Mahayana, compassion is the emphasis put on compassion. And in the Vajrayana, the emphasis is put on devotion. And that's how indifference is transformed. Okay. But there are other methods for other... In all of the traditions, they have methods for that. But that's one way of looking at it. We're not going to be touching on devotion per se in this work, but we'll have other methods. In fact, the first method we're going to be using, equanimity, is very much directed at the equality of indifference. Okay? Other questions or points for clarification? Anything else? Okay. Deborah, we're ready. Deborah's going to hand out the meditation practices for... which he very kindly put together at my request, which I only passed on to her today. So thank you very much for this last-minute effort. Actually, I could use one, too. Does everybody have one? Okay. One page. Now, my plan for this class, we have six sessions. This is the first one. Over the next 2 weeks, we're going to work with equanimity. And then loving kindness, compassion, and joy. That will take us up to the fifth week, our fifth class. And then we'll have one more class after that, kind of wrap it all up. And I do want you to proceed in this order. In the Theravadin tradition, they start with loving-kindness because they're using that to drive everything else. In the Mahayana, because it has more emphasis on space and openness, they start with equanimity. Part of the reason there is in order to develop these emotions for everybody, Mahayana perspective is you got to get rid of prejudice and preference first. Now, I wrote these four lines, and they're actually a compilation of techniques from the Theravada and Mahayana and Dzogchen and Mahamudra traditions, all rolled into four lines, just so you know. And many of you will be used to meditations based on aphorisms, which will be worded very similarly to this. These are not aphorisms. These aren't even wishes, even though they're framed in that kind of vocabulary. Rather, each line is intended to put you in touch with areas in us where the particular immeasurable is either blocked or is already present. And as you say each of these lines, you're going to feel that. You're going to feel those areas. So the way you work here, if you take the first one, may I be free from preference and prejudice? Just take a moment and say that first line to yourself. May I be free from preference and prejudice? Okay. What happens when you say it? What happens in you? Anybody? Now, I should put a note here before I forget. For people who are listening on the podcast, these four lines are available, or this page is available in a PDF file on the website, so you can go there and get it. Did you kick it up to Franca? Okay. Please? No. Now that I've said it, I'd really appreciate it. Okay. So what happens when you say, may I be free from preference and prejudice? Joe?
I want it to be different.
You want it to be different?
The line, yeah.
Why?
Oh, because I don't quite understand it. I don't know what it means. I don't know what it's going to do. I wish it was simpler. You think I have any preferences or prejudices?
And if you go below that set of reactions, what do you find?
Oh, fear that I will fail, that I will look bad, that I will not be who I think I am.
So you can hear all of this judgmental quality about yourself.
Yes.
Right? Now, what if you just let that be there? What happens?
It just is there.
And how do you feel?
Fine.
Okay. So this is the method of practice. You say these lines, all of the stuff comes up. As a friend of mine would say, the monsters come out of the basement. What do you do with them? Well, with long experience with these monsters, chasing them doesn't work very well. Trying to get them back in the basement doesn't work very well. They're there. And so when you say these lines, you may become acutely aware of how prejudiced you are or how much preference actually operates. And you may be very uncomfortable with that. Well, guess what? You just got your first reward from the practice. Now you experience it. Because that's the point. When we don't experience it, that's when we exercise preference and prejudice. When we can experience it as an arising in ourself, that's where we become free of having to express preference and prejudice. And eventually we come to know that it's just an arising, and it loses its enchantment, its ability to enthrall and enslave. Catherine, you have a microphone?
So what if you feel release and space when you say that line?
Then you rest in the release and space.
Does that mean later other things are going to come up?
You know, Catherine, I have no idea.
Thank you.
You're just going to have to find out. Okay. So let's take the second line. May I know all things without judgment. What happens there? Catherine, what happened there?
When I say that, I don't think it's ever going to happen.
You don't believe it?
I feel tense.
Oh, so this must mean you view things with a certain amount of judgment now.
The word judgment.
Hmm. That rings some bells, doesn't
yes.
it?
Ah. So I do feel tense.
So can you just experience that?
Yes, I'm going to just experience it.
Do you like experiencing
no.
it? No. Okay, you got the point. Good. Anybody else when you say these lines? Deborah, microphone's right here.
I feel resistance because there are so many things that are just wrong, and I know that.
Amen.
Thank you. Yeah, I understand.
I don't want to let go of it.
Yes. What determines whether something's wrong?
Depends on what it is, but to an extent, how much pain or suffering it causes.
That's one possible factor, but is that always?
Well, no, me. I would be the other thing that always determines.
Yeah. Basically, it's our idea of the world, right? What would it be like to experience things, experiencing the world without having any preconceived idea about it?
It would be very relaxing, like just stepping into a flow.
Okay. Interested in the possibility?
Maybe.
Okay.
But there are so many things that are wrong.
There you go. Right. So knowing what's these things are wrong and these things are right, that's kind of a comfort for you, isn't it? Yeah. Just experiencing things, that's like, don't know how to navigate that. Okay. And for many people, that's the case. So when you're stepping into an immeasurable, you're stepping into a very, very different world. Now, I want to make clear, this doesn't mean that we just say, oh, well, you know, mass murder, that's just fine. It doesn't mean that. Thich Nhat Hanh, in a poem, I think it was called Remember My Name. The last line is particularly, it goes into this. It says, he's writing about the boat people in Vietnam after the fall of Vietnam, in this one line anyway, and says, I'm the 10-year-old girl who was raped by a sea pirate, and I am the sea pirate who was so blind he did not know what he was doing. I am the 10-year-old girl who was raped by a sea pirate, and I am the sea pirate who's so blind he did not know what he was doing. That's along the lines of without judgment. Doesn't make it right, but it opens the possibility of seeing the other, the person, even though they're doing something totally heinous, as a human being. Okay? But it runs straight into those categories we have inside, just as you're describing. Okay, let's try the third line. May I experience the world knowing me just as I am. Rory. There's a, well, there's a little more than a sigh there.
Initially when I read it, it just made me feel warm inside. But listening to some of the comments about the first two lines, it almost balances out the first two.
Mm-hmm. Anybody find this terrifying? Okay, few people find that. So again, it's going to bring up material where there's resistance to this kind of complete openness and equanimity, and or it will move you into where you feel a resonance with that openness and equanimity. May I see things just as they are. Now, we all say that we want to do that. How many of you actually want to do that? No. As I like to say, most people don't want to be aware. They just want to feel that they are aware. Because when we are aware, we have no choice about what we are aware of. We are just aware. Most people don't want that. So, may I see things just as they are is declaring an intention to be that aware. So, the way that you work here is for the first week at least, in your meditation period, just rest for about 10 or 15 minutes with your breath. And then say these four lines, one by one, slowly. And with each one, you're going to feel stuff. You're going to feel a shift of some kind. And you just experience that shift. And I want, this is where we go back to stuff that we've discussed before. What do you experience in your body? Always start with your body. Now, sometimes there'll be a tensing, sometimes there'll be a relaxing. People have commented on that already. And then note the emotional ones. And you may have to say the same line again. You may say the first line several times. And the point is, you keep saying it so that you are able to note and be right in all of the reactions and responses to that line. And then you say the second line. Go through the same process. And then the third line, and go through the same process. And then the fourth line, and go through the same process. Now, it may be that things get a little bit hot in there, in which case, just rest with the breath for a while, allowing those all of that stuff just to be there and experiencing it to the extent that you can. I want to emphasize that if you find yourself hardening against the experience, let everything go. That's not doing you any good. If you're experiencing it and you're hardening it and it's like this, just let it go, rest with the breath, and then bring it back. One needs to have a firmness, but also a suppleness or a softness. If you're hardening or tensing up against it, not so helpful. In the course of 15 or 20 minutes of this, you may go through these once, twice, maybe three times. If you're going through it more than that, you're probably going a bit too quickly. But you can tell me how it goes. The point here is actually to feel the resonances with each of the lines. So at the end of 15 or 20 minutes, then just let everything go and rest. If you know how to rest in open awareness, do that. If you're not familiar with that form of practice, then just rest with the breath and allow all of the emotional stuff that may have been stirred up just to be there and allow it to dissipate, disperse in its own way. Don't try to control it. Just rest with the breath and let it be there. So that should be about a 30 to 40 minute period. Realistically, you should be aiming for more for 40 to 45 minutes rather than 30 minutes if you want to use this practice fruitfully. 10 or 15 minutes to allow the attention to rest. 15 to 20 minutes rest, working with the actual meditation. And then 10, 15 minutes just resting again at the end. That kind of sandwich approach is very effective. In the beginning, you're going to work with yourself. It's, may I be free from preference and prejudice. You're going to experience all of these things. 2 weeks is a relatively short time to work on this, but after about a week or 10 days, then I'd like you to start extending it. So you're going to replace the I with, may those close to me be free of preference and prejudice. May those close to me see things without judgment. And you're going to notice it's a very, very different feeling, because now you're developing this aspiration or this intention with respect to others. And you may find yourself feeling things like Shantideva says, well, it was fine as long as it was focused on me, but as soon as it focused on others, I'm not interested. We have these little quirks in us. And see what that experience is. When you're doing this as a complete practice, you would start off with those that you feel close to you, that you like. Then you'd move it to people you feel indifferent about. And then you'd move it to people you really don't like. You know, may those people, people you really have trouble with. And this is how we actually establish the quality of equanimity within ourselves and with respect to everything that we experience. Now, are you going to be able to do all of that in 2 weeks? Probably not, but I want to give you the framework for this so that you know where the practice is headed. Any questions about the practice? Kate, then Michelle, and then Carol. Carolyn, sorry. Some people, I'm just terrible with names.
When I read these lines, for instance, may I know all things without judgment, I mean, I obviously know that I have judgment, more judgment about some things than other things. So would it be helpful to bring up in my mind, you know, the things that I have more judgment about and sit with that?
Or is that necessary? When you say those lines, don't they just pop up?
Well, in the very beginning, it all sounded good to me. Until I started thinking about the things that I have more judgment about.
Yeah, and so there it is. So,
okay.
And now the next time you say those lines, there they are. Mm-hmm. And you got to experience not only having judgment about those things, but having judgment about you having judgment.
Mm-hmm. So it'll all come up anyway.
That's my experience here. Yeah, mm-hmm. Michelle?
I think I already know the answer to this one.
Good.
But what about the opposite of Shantideva's reaction? May those close to me be free from preference and prejudice, because then, of course, they'll see things my way.
Yes, you're quite right. some of us go one way and some of us go the other. But you're what's your way?
Whatever I think is right at the moment, of course.
Yes. Is that free from judgment?
Well, that of course would depend on whether my ego or something else was speaking.
Yes, but that's why we start with us. Because if we started with others, we could actually go there. But when we start with us, first we have to be free of it. And just letting some of that stuff go, like, that's really uncomfortable, right? So that's why we start with us, okay? Carolyn.
Thank you. This is just practical. You said we should start with ourselves, and then after how long?
I would like you to spend at least a week working just with these four lines with respect to selves, and then experiment with expanding it to include others.
Okay. And when we do that, we shouldn't probably go through those four lines more than two or three times in a session. I mean, that's about the speed you're recommending.
Yeah, three or four times, I think. You may find it goes faster than that because there's a lot of variation between from people, but it's not a case of just saying the line, okay, I feel that, going on to the next line. The purpose of Buddhist practice is to experience whatever arises So we say that. And at least in my experience, I say something like this, it arises, and I'm in experience for about 2 or 3 seconds, and then I check out. You know, like something takes me off. When a pattern releases, it's a very different thing, because then when it arises, there's a shift, and then you find yourself just present. And if that happens, just rest there. That's fine. But I find that when we're working with uncomfortable material, it's very easy to get distracted. I mean, the body sensations rise, and we say, yeah, stay with the body sensations. And then we immediately start thinking, well, you know, if I just did this, that would feel better. And and we're already out of it, just like that. Do you know what I mean? So this is very much working with the experience. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Susan.
I could sort of anticipate particular lines giving rise to perhaps strong ideas or emotions.
Yes.
Is the instruction to, is it kind of a Dzogchen instruction, just rest in awareness and do nothing? Or is there something...
And what would you like to do?
Well, the other one is, there's ways to work with it. You can move into it and try and experience it fully.
And what's the difference between that and Dzogchen?
Sometimes it just dissolves and nothing happens. I mean, like...
Sometimes it just dissolves. Sometimes when you move into it, it just dissolves. What's the difference?
Sometimes when you move into it, you get dragged into a whole thing.
And sometimes when you just sit with it open, you get completely distracted. Mm-hmm. What's the difference?
What if you're just open and then you move on to the next line?
Ah, it sounds like you're moving too quickly. Slow down. Okay. Any other questions? Linnea? Then we need to close for the evening.
Is there any reason not to work with these off the cushion?
Pardon?
Is there any reason not to work with these off the cushion?
Oh, no. It's great to work with these in your daily life. Thank you for raising that up. Yeah. If you memorize these and just go around saying them all the time, thank you very much for bringing that point up, and just learn them by heart, that's really good. And so that way you keep the practice going through the day. Yeah. Okay. Dedication? Before you start. So and this, this I'm saying for the benefit of the podcast. So this is the end of the first class in the equanimity. And you can find more information about Unfettered Mind on our website, unfetteredmind.org.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.